When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
You may be the first president in history to go down because you can't stop inappropriately talking about an investigation.
I can definitively say the president's not a liar, and I think it's frankly insulting that question would be asked.
Up to now, we have no profiles in courage among the Republicans. Somebody really speaking out saying Trump is bad for the country.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about President Donald Trump, the new gravitational force that defines our politics. I'm Jamel Bowie, Slate's chief political correspondent and your host for today's show. On Tuesday, Virginia Democrats nominated a candidate for governor. They chose Ralph Northam, the sitting lieutenant governor, over Tom Perriello, a former congressman and self-described pragmatic populist. Both ran vigorous, progressive campaigns, but Northam, with his strong ties to the state party and deep relationships with Democratic lawmakers, prevailed. Virginia Republicans also chose a candidate for governor, former Republican National Committee Chair Ed Gillespie, who nearly toppled Mark Warner in the state's 2014 Senate race. But Gillespie, the favorite, expected to score an easy victory, barely crossed the finish line, squeaking by with just a few thousand votes to spare. Who nearly toppled Gillespie in an upset that would have upended the gubernatorial race? Corey Stewart, the Minnesota-born conservative whose slogan, "Take Back Virginia," captured the core of his campaign. He was running as a Trump-like figure, railing against illegal immigration, transgender bathrooms, and other Republicans, slamming them as sellouts. He centered his campaign on an aggressive defense of Virginia's Confederate monuments and memorials, holding events at sites like the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville and marching with neo-Confederate activists. He sent a clear message that his was a campaign for an older, whiter Virginia, one that seeks to wrest the state away from its growing majority of immigrants, Black Americans, and liberal college-educated whites. Virginia is a sometimes parochial state with its own issues and concerns. But the national tenor of the Democratic race, where both Perriello and Northam ran as anti-Trump progressives, and the Trump-like campaign of Corey Stewart act as loud echoes of politics around the country. We are seeing how the parties are adapting in the age of Trump, and that makes Virginia worth our attention. I'll be talking to Carolyn Fidler, a longtime observer of Virginia politics, about the governor's race. But first, a few tweets.
I believe the James Comey leaks will be far more prevalent than anyone ever thought possible. Totally illegal, very cowardly. The Democrats have no message, not on economics, not on taxes, not on jobs, not on failing hashtag Obamacare. They are only obstructionists. Fake news is at an all-time high. Where is their apology to me for all of the incorrect stories? They made up a phony conclusion with the Russian story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice. You are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people. Crooked H destroyed phones with hammers, bleached emails, and had husband meet with attorney general days before she was cleared. And they talk about obstruction.
Our guest today to discuss the Virginia gubernatorial race and what it means is Carolyn Fidler, a political editor and communications advisor for Daily Kos, and a longtime observer and participant in Virginia politics. Hi, Carolyn. Welcome to TrumpCast.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess for listeners who were not following the gubernatorial race so closely, people voted on Tuesday. The winner in the Virginia Democratic primary was Ralph Northam, who is the currently serving lieutenant governor. And the winner in the Republican primary was Ed Gillespie, who was RNC chair during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, ran for Senate in 2014 against Mark Warner, and now is the Republican nominee for governor. But that sort of in line with expectations take, that's kind of the outcome people expected, I think obscures a lot of very interesting things happening right beneath the surface. So with the Democratic race, let's just start there. What did you think? Were you surprised by any part of the result? Northam's competitor was Tom Perriello, a former congressman. He got about 44% of the vote to Northam's 55%. Was there anything about that result that shocked you?
I was surprised that Northam won so handily. I'm not surprised that he won. He'd been running for governor for a long time. He had a lot of structural party advantages behind him. And his roots in the Commonwealth were just deeper than Perriello's. And for Virginia Democratic primary voters, that matters.
So one thing that I think – I mean, one reason this race even got national attention beyond the fact that it was sort of one of the marquee – one of the first races under the Trump presidency, it's just that it very quickly became a referendum on Trump within the Democratic primary kind of electorate, who was more vigorously anti-Trump. And from my perspective, it seems like Perriello is the one who, in entering the race, brought this to the fore, and Northam quickly kind of basically bid him up. I think at one point Northam called Trump a narcissistic maniac? Was maniac the word?
Yes, it was maniac.
But how much, I wanted to ask, like, how much did you think anti-Trump sentiment factored into people's decision-making? And do you think that, you know, looking forward to November, do you think that anti-Trump, whatever anti-Trump sentiment is there, do you think it will have an influence then?
I think the anti-Trump sentiment definitely fueled turnout, if nothing else. Both Perriello and Northam were very stridently anti-Trump, as well as they should have been. But Democratic turnout in the governor's race was another really shocking factor. It was extremely high. In fact, someone did the math, and if Virginia had the sort of top-two primary system that California has, Perriello and Northam would be going to the general and not Gillespie.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. It was Republican turnout was abysmal.
So what?
Very good sign.
So with Democrats, I guess that, like, what's turnout normally like for a Virginia Democratic gubernatorial primary?
It's a good sight lower than it was. I believe I saw a figure that was 130% over normal, but I should double check that. But I was looking at one race in particular, one House delegates primary, and was comparing the Democratic primary turnout to the total Democratic votes that the Democrat in that district got last time, and the general election turnout was not much higher 2 years ago than the primary turnout was on Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
So that, I mean, it seems like that says something positive for Democratic chances in the fall.
It does. Democrats are engaged and excited, and we didn't just see that in turnout on Tuesday. We saw that in the number of candidates running for House of Delegates seats. There were 16 primaries or challengers vying to take on Republican incumbents. And that's, I believe, 2 years ago, there were only, I want to say, three or four. It's an amazing sign. There's just so much energy and engagement. Democrats not just turning out to march and volunteer, but stepping up to run for office, which is no easy task. It's a big hill to climb.
So, I mean, from my perspective, this really does seem like a function of President Trump, that President Trump just energized a lot of people to want to get involved at that level.
It's true. But in March, I went down to a candidate training in Richmond, and I spoke to a lot of these folks who are running for office. And a lot of them were inspired to run because of their feelings about Trump. It was like he crystallized the sense of social obligation that was already there, the sort of sense of community that they already had. Most of these people were already community activists and already very involved. But Trump made them want to take that next step and run for office. I mean, they all had their feelings about Trump, but when I spoke with each of them about their districts and their opponents, they knew exactly what they were running for and what they were running against in Richmond and who their opponent was and what needed to change locally for them. So it's a twofold thing, I think.
Now, on the other side, there was a Republican primary, and that, I mean, I'll just say up front, that was shocking.
It was. Oh, gosh.
Gillespie barely won. There was three candidates. Gillespie, a sort of firebrand Trump-style candidate named Corey Stewart, and then someone whose name I do not recall at the moment.
Frank Wagner. Poor Frank Wagner.
who is sort of like the moderate in the race relative to the other two competitors. And Gillespie ended up winning by, I want to say, around 4,700, 4,800 votes, a squeaker of a race. And at one point, the dividing line between him and his next competitor, Corey Stewart, was less than 1,000 votes. The reason why this is shocking is that Stewart, you know, it's one thing to say Stewart was sort of like a Trump-like candidate, but that's not an exaggeration or any sort of shoehorn him into some kind of mold. He ran basically on the defense of Confederate monuments in the state and on xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment.
I mean, in many ways, I think with the Confederacy defense he was running, I feel like in some ways he was more extreme than Trump. His going to rallies and making bold statements about Confederate monuments coming down, and by bold statements, I mean racist statements. But I hadn't seen anything like it in Virginia. I mean, there are a lot of dog whistles over time. I remember George Allen with his noose he would keep in his law office, and how when he was questioned about that, he said it symbolized frontier justice. But to have Corey Stewart coming out and speaking about the Confederacy in such a romantic way, it was nothing I'd ever seen before.
So my question for you is, what does this mean? I mean, what does it mean that Stewart almost became the nominee? I mean, if it had rained in like the wrong places, he could have become the nominee.
No, I think that's right. And part of Corey Stewart's relative success on Tuesday was based around the fact that Republican turnout was so low. Democrats were super energized and Republicans were super not. Low turnout definitely helped Corey Stewart, because the sort of rabid crazies who would support the kinds of things that he speaks in favor of are the ones who definitely get out to vote. And your more sort of run-of-the-mill Republican that you know tends to hew more towards Gillespie seems to be much less motivated this year. And that's a great sign for Democrats and troubling for Republicans on several levels. I mean, people aren't excited about Republicans. Republicans aren't excited about Republicans. And there's this fringe element that's gaining strength. And that is a really bad sign for them.
Right. That's what I wanted to ask you about, because I confess, like, I've always been skeptical that the Trump thing could translate down to other candidates in other environments. And if there was ever a place where it seemed like a Trump-style candidate couldn't get traction, it was Virginia, even with the state's experience with sort of hard right candidates like Ken Cuccinelli or E.W. Jackson or whomever, the mood and feel and ethos of Virginia Republicans has tended to be pretty kind of not moderate, but
not crazy,
pragmatic, sort of traditional. You know, these are business suit Republicans when it comes down to it.
Right.
So why do you think Corey Stewart's Trump-like act appealed? Like how – I should say, looking at the maps, you know, you would assume that it appealed most in the rural parts of the state, and it did. But Stewart didn't do poorly in parts of Northern Virginia, He didn't do poorly in parts of Hampton Roads, which is where I'm from. So there's something happening there, and I'm not really sure what it is.
Yeah, it seems a little too soon to really come to stark conclusions for that, but the indicators are not good. I mean, the Northern Virginia thing, to an extent, can be explained away by the fact that he's head of the Prince William Board of Supervisors, which is also inexplicable to me because he's terrible and has a long history of racially charged policies, primarily against Latinos and Hispanics in the area. But, he at least had name recognition, but Hampton Roads is his good performance there is really shocking, and his shockingly strong performance overall is something that definitely merits a lot of scrutiny from both political scientists and analysts and from the Republican Party itself. They have a lot of self-reflection to do to figure out what they need to do if this is the party they're going to be now, if that's what spells success for them, or if they are going to continue to try to appeal to a broader base of normal humans.
So on that note, I mean, what do you think this means for Gillespie in the fall? I mean, in the late period of the primary campaign, even he was promising to defend Confederate monuments in the state. So do you think this sort of creates an almost impossible rope to walk for him?
Oh, it makes his journey much harder, for sure. Like you said, he definitely hewed more to the right, more to the crazy pro-Confederate side, which is just something I can't believe I'm saying in 2017. And Corey Stewart is reluctantly sort of backed him, but says things like Gillespie's got to earn my supporters' support, and that's not a positive sign for the Republican Party in the Commonwealth this fall. The excitement is low to begin with, and if not everyone who voted for Corey Stewart is going to come out and vote for Ed Gillespie, he's dead in the water.
Now, aside from the gubernatorial race, and you mentioned the House of Delegates races and kind of the General Assembly races, where does that look? Because one of the kind of the problems in Virginia politics as of late, as with national politics, is just that there's been this divide, partisan divide in the legislature and then the governor's mansion, which has made sort of any actual progress on things very difficult. And so does it look like things are changing in the legislative level?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mentioned the high level of excitement and the many, many Democratic candidates that came out of the woodwork this year to run. But that has to be set against the harsh reality of the fact that the House of Delegates in Virginia is terribly, terribly gerrymandered. And the state that went in the last three presidential elections for the Democratic candidate, Democrats only hold 34 seats in a 100-seat House, and that is largely a function of gerrymandering. That said, that is not something that can't be overcome. It would take a wave, and it takes Democrats running everywhere they can run, and that's absolutely happening this year. Out of 100 seats in the House of Delegates, Democrats have candidates in 87 of them.
Oh wow, that's very unusual and impressive.
Yes. 2 years ago, they had candidates in 56 or 57, if I recall correctly. Not all that many. So there are very few Republicans going unchallenged. And the ones that are going unchallenged are in, very, very difficult districts, all the top tier races, as they're known. And the parlance have great candidates. A lot of them had primaries, a lot of them didn't, but all these candidates are very, very strong, very motivated, very talented, have really great personal stories. They're all raising money. Things look really rosy for Democrats this fall.
Okay, so one last question. For listeners who are not as attuned to Virginia politics, should they look at these races, these House of Delegates races, this governor's race, as having, real national significance? Does this really matter in terms of kind of the ongoing political back and forth between Trump and the Democratic Party? Or is this like kind of just a parochial thing?
I don't think it's a parochial thing, but I also am hesitant to super nationalize it. Virginia is right next to D.C., and is one of those few states that has its elections when almost no one else has elections. New Jersey is also having elections this year. So all eyes are on Virginia in a way they might not be if this were an odd numbered year with a lot of other elections on the ballot. That said, Virginia is has been definitely trending more and more Democratic over the past 12 years, I guess we can safely say. And seeing how that sort of plays out this fall is going to tell both parties a lot about politics in the age of Trump and what it means to have Trump kind of overshadowing the rest of a ticket. So it's going to be very educational.
I have been speaking to Carolyn Fidler, political editor and communications advisor for Daily Kos. Thank you for joining me today, Carolyn.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's the show for today. Did you like it? If so, reach out to us on Twitter. You can follow us there as @RealTrumpCast to keep up with all the latest from the TrumpCast team. That's @RealTrumpCast. And be sure to stick around after today's credits to listen to the first episode of a new Slate show, TrumpCare Tracker. There, you can hear my colleagues Jordan Weissman and Jim Newell discuss all things healthcare. The show goes up every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can find it on Apple's podcast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to stick around until the very end here to catch the first episode of Trump Care Tracker. Today's show is produced by Jason DeLeon, and I'm Jamel Bowie. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.